Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this evening's Dharma talk. The subject of this evening's talk is on emptiness, your real nature. This is where we take the insight practice to a deeper level, that you to understand how you find out who you are. And of course, that is such an important question to find the answer for. It's really the heart of all religions and spiritual quests. And it's important for science as well, to find out not just through blind belief, but through bare experience, to know for yourself exactly who you are and what you're doing here. And this is the essence of the goal. So today I'm going to talk about that, and exactly how we find out, but the whole process is how we use these meditation practices which I've outlined so far to see deeply and truly into the nature of you. But first of all, I'm going to be continuing on with the process of deep insight. Yesterday I gave a lot of examples, but I deliberately avoided the examples of the insight into the nature of the self, simply because I wanted to reserve that topic exclusively for this evening's talk. But I will begin with a very important simile on how hard it is to see the truth. Because here we're breaking through delusion. The Buddha said that the root cause of suffering is not seeing clearly, it's being deluded. And many people find it so hard to break through deluded. How many people here are deluded? Put up your hands. But if you are, how come you can't see it? I'll tell you now, this wonderful simile, why it is that people cannot see through what delusion is. And this is a story of one of the monks I grew up with. As you know, that I've been a monk over 30 years now. So that some of my fellow monks were US veterans of the Vietnam War. And one particular monk, he joined the military as a US Marine. He was a real tough guy. He told me when we chatted over the years we spent together that before he was a monk, he was basically a delinquent, a lout, who would join a street gang in one of the towns in actually Buffalo, New York. And he said that he would go around with motorbike chains. He called it playing for keeps. He was a very violent and nasty man. And he joined the US Marines to get tougher. He volunteered. It's incredible just how some of the most violent, aggressive, mean and nasty, heartless men can, after some experiences, end up as monks. Some of the most gentle and kind and peaceful people you could possibly imagine. But he started off being extremely violent. And he said that in one of the major battles in Vietnam during that war, he was a radio operator, and his group of soldiers were caught in a firefight with the Viet Cong, with bullets flying everywhere. And one of his best friends got a bullet in the foot, what they called a $1 million wound, because even though it hurt, it was not life-threatening. It meant that he would soon leave Vietnam and go back to the United States with an honorable discharge and a good pension. That's why it was a lucky wound. And as he was looking at his friend's wound and laughing, just how lucky you were, he took a bullet in the back of the head. It was a moment of heedlessness, and a Viet Cong sniper got him in the back of the head. Because he was a radio operator, the radio was there, they called for the chopper straight away. He got evacuated, but he said even as they were loading him in the chopper, a shell hit close by, shrapnel went through his body and threw him to the other side of the helicopter. He really thought there was no hope for him. He went to die. However, the next thing he knew, he was in the hospital. He didn't die. The medics could save his life. But once he came out of the operation, because he was a US Marine, because he was supposed to be a tough guy. The doctors did not try and be diplomatic. They just told him that he would certainly lose his sight. The part of the brain which was damaged by the bullet, which they had to take out, was a part to do with sight. He was going to be a blind man. And he told me that when he heard that news, he never got depressed. He was tough. He just decided there and then, very clearly, as soon as he had the opportunity, he would commit suicide. He did not want to live his life without his sight. So it was a very clear and tough decision. He made it without any remorse at all. However, what happened when the bandages were removed? To his surprise, and even the doctor's surprise, he could see. No one knew why, but you know, his eyes were perfect. And so he was discharged from the hospital. He had his pension, about $1,000 a month. 30 years ago, that was a huge amount of money. And he was just delighting in the ability to be free, not to have to work, and just to enjoy himself, having been seriously wounded, a hero. His parents respected him. He was young, he was fit, he had his faculties. He had a depression in the back of the head where the skull was removed and an iron plate was put in. Other than that, he was so healthy and so fit. And he said he was just enjoying life. What happened on one day? Eventually he became a monk. But before that happened, he said one day he was in the park playing baseball with his friends. And the batsman hit the ball. It was going to be a home run, but it was in his direction. And he was about to catch it. As you do when you're trying to catch a ball, you follow the trajectory with your eye, getting ready to catch it. When? The ball just disappeared, completely vanished from the universe. And he was stunned because balls don't vanish. What on earth has happened to it? A second or two later, it reappeared. He found out he had a blind spot caused by the injury in the Vietnam War. And only then did he know that there was a gap in his vision. Before that time, he explained that the mind fills in that gap with what it expects to see there. And the mind is so clever, if you have a blind spot, a portion of your vision which has been destroyed, you don't see it. You can't see like a black spot in the middle, a black smudge in the middle of your field of vision. The mind fills it in, what it expects to be there. However, because he went to catch a ball, the mind couldn't really work out what was going on, and so the ball vanished. And that's when he realized he had the blind spot. Now I use this simile to teach people what delusion is like. Sometimes we can go through our whole life not realizing we've got a blind spot in our understanding, because the mind fills in all the details, what it expects to be there. And because of that, because of wishful thinking, which bends our perceptions to suit, we don't see what's there. We see what we expect to be there. That's why delusion is so hard to find out. You need some special situation, some special case, which proves to you there's a blind spot there, because you know that baseballs don't suddenly vanish and reappear again. He realized by the influence of that experience, yeah, that is a blind spot. It is a job of insight to put you into such strange situations that all your inferences about what should be true are just confounded. They're proved to be false. So you can see the blind spots in your wisdom. One of the other similes I gave today in the interviews, which shows you why you have to have experiences like a jhana to uncover those blind spots which you cannot see in any other way. And it's a simile of the tadpole. You can imagine a tadpole has been born in the water, grown up in the water, lived all its life in the water. How do you think a tadpole can understand what water is? It's always been there. It's always been around it. In fact, there is no way a tadpole could really understand what water is. But one day, the tadpole grows its legs and hops out of the pond, and it hops onto dry land. Only then, when it's out of the water, when it's free of the medium in which it's lived for all its life, only then has it got a perspective, a means to compare, an opportunity to know what water is like. Only when the frog leaves the lake can it know what water is. In the same way, only when you leave your five senses can you ever have the opportunity of knowing what these five senses are. You've always had sight, sound, smell and taste, touch. But when you get the jhanas, they're no longer there for you. Only then do you understand what they are. You've had the body for all your life, obviously. Only when you leave your body do you understand what the body truly is. Somebody asked me today also in the interviews, a part of the job of insight is to understand the difference between mind and body. Sometimes people call it nama and rupa. What is the difference between mind and body? You cannot know that difference just through thinking about it. The blind spots are just too strong. The only way you can know what the body is when the body disappears. Just like the person or the frog gets out of the lake, only then can you know what water is. Only when you've left your body behind to understand truly what the body is. Now you understand the process of insight, how it happens. Because when you get into these deep states of mind, when you leave the body and the senses behind, you're just left with the mind, only then can you really understand what's going on. But in particular, there's one important experience of the jhanas is something which is very essential to you, which disappears only in the jhanas. It is something which you've had since the time you were born, which has always been there, which always should be there, which shouldn't go disappearing, but which does disappear in the jhana states. And that is your will, your choice, your ability to decide what you're going to do next, your command structure. All of that disappears within the jhanas. That is why they are very strange and weird states. It is the only time in your life that you get into these states. You're perfectly aware, but you cannot do anything. Even the potential to do is completely stripped away from you, but you are still there. It's only when the will disappears can you have any understanding at all of what the will is. In the same way, only when the frog leaves the lake can it understand what water is. Only when you leave behind will can you understand what choice and will truly are. To understand that, I have a famous simile which I constructed quite a few years ago, which people really liked. It set them spinning. It's called the simile of the driverless bus. I mentioned this simile yesterday and I promised I would say it today and explain it. You may imagine your life like this. Life is often compared to a journey. Imagine the journey is spent in a bus. And the bus is your body. Now this bus journey which you're on, sometimes it's very pleasant, sometimes it's very unpleasant. Just like sometimes the bus goes through this very beautiful territory, just rolling hills, nice and green, these beautiful limestone hills like in Ipoh. Sometimes it's very, very scenic. And sometimes your bus goes through the most terrible, disgusting, ugly, repugnant territory. Like, you know, sometimes it goes through wastelands or shanty towns or toxic nuclear waste dumps. Whatever it is you don't like, sometimes the bus goes through those. In this simile, I mean that sometimes in your life you have fun, everything is nice and peaceful and lovely, sometimes it gets very difficult and very painful and very, very disappointing. You've all known those times of your life. Now going back to the simile of the bus, when the bus is going through the beautiful territory, you tell the bus driver, slow down, even stop. This is so nice outside, I want to enjoy it as long as I possibly can. That is your instruction to the bus driver when you have beautiful scenery around you. But sometimes, even though it's beautiful scenery and you give very clear instructions, the bus driver puts his foot on the accelerator and speeds through. In this simile, sometimes your happy, pleasant times, they don't seem to last as long as they should do. You wonder, why is it I can't keep myself happy or keep my life peaceful and happy and successful as long as I should be able to? At other times, the bus goes to terrible, toxic, waste-like territories, and you tell the driver, hurry up, get out of here as quick as possible. This is terrible scenery. And very often, not always, the bus driver slows down and stops. And you're stuck with this pain and suffering longer than you should do. This is like life. When life gets difficult and painful and disappointing and frustrating, when you have all the problems, how come you can't get out of it quickly? And so, you want to tell the bus driver what to do. The bus driver, and here that means your will, is not following the instructions. In suffering, you tell it to get out quickly. In happiness, you tell it to slow down. And very often, it does the opposite. Have you ever noticed that? Why is it your suffering lasts too long and your happiness doesn't last long enough? And you've been trying all your life to solve that problem, to have more happiness and less suffering. To be able to go through the beautiful scenery and linger there, and to rush out of the terrible scenery in a bus. So, switching the metaphors and similes again, when you go into the bus, you're really fed up with this bus driver, with you. You're completely stupid, you never do the right thing, so you want to find out where this bus driver is, to teach this bus driver how to drive the bus. Listen, bus driver, when it's happiness and fun, slow down, stop. When it's unpleasant, speed out, okay? You want to find your will, you, to try and instruct yourself how to be happy and how to escape from suffering. And after a long journey, you finally find the bus driver's seat. It's not an easy thing to find. In this particular case, you've got to find your will. Who is doing all of this? Who chose to come on this retreat? Who chose to come and listen to this talk this evening? Now, who's been deciding all of these things you've done over the last years of your life? Who's in charge? Where is this bus driver, this will? Because if you can find out who's in control of you, then maybe you can instruct it to do a better job of your life. And finally, through meditation, through this jhana business, you find the bus driver's seat. You go into the middle of this lotus and find what will truly is. In the simile of the bus driver's seat, you get the deep insight. And as I said yesterday, the real good insights, the deep ones, they shock you. It's not what you expect, but it's true. It's uncovering a blind spot. You find that the bus driver's seat is completely empty. There's no one there. That's why I call it the driverless bus. You go deep inside of yourself to find out who is pulling the strings who is at the wheel and at the pedals of your life? And you find your bus driver's seat is empty. Emptiness. There's no one there. And of course, that shocks you. It's not what you expected. But I guarantee you, as the Buddha says in non-self, it is very true. Once you see that, it has huge consequences for your life. Once you see there's no bus driver there, that your will is completely conditioned, it's not a being, a person, it's not you deciding what to do, then you go back to your seat and you stop complaining. If it's suffering, there's no one to complain to anymore. If it's happiness, there's no one to complain to anymore. You stop your craving. When you see the emptiness of the will, all the craving suddenly vanishes. There's no point to it anymore. But then people ask me, quite reasonably, well, who is choosing then? Who is doing this? Why did I come here? What's going on? And you will find any scientist or psychologist will tell you, just as the Buddha said, that which you take to be will is just a completely conditioned process going according to causes, and it's so easy to prove that. Just look at advertising. You look at advertisements on the TV, in the movies, in the glossy magazines, and you think you are so sophisticated it doesn't affect you. Maybe other people are stupid enough to buy into those adverts and buy those type of shoes or buy that washing powder or buy that brand of noodles. But I thought I was sophisticated when I was young. But look what happened to me. Once there was this advertisement on the TV, and I remember it very clearly, and I bring it up as an example in many of my talks, for St. Bruno Tobacco. I still remember the name, St. Bruno Tobacco. And in those days, when people didn't realize that smoking was dangerous, it was quite cool to actually just smoke a pipe. In this wooden pipe, you put the tobacco in the end, and you puffed it. Now, in this advertisement, I never really used to smoke at all, certainly not cigarettes. But in this advertisement on the TV, there was this ordinary looking guy who was walking down the street alone, had no companion. But then he got out his pipe, he stuffed the end of it with his St. Bruno tobacco and lit it up. And the aroma coming from this tobacco wafted into a bank. And there was this incredibly beautiful girl behind the counter who smelled one sniff of this tobacco and was completely obsessed, jumped over the counter and followed this ordinary looking man, completely obsessed by him. And then they passed a newsagent, another incredibly beautiful girl, was completely enamored, and she ran out of the shop and also followed this man, completely in love with him. And then somebody came out of the baker's. After a few minutes, this ordinary looking man was followed by these seven or eight very, very sexy girls. And I call it absolutely stupid. I mean, you girls don't sort of follow a man because of tobacco he smokes. However, even though it's absolutely stupid, guess who brought some St. Bruno tobacco? But it never worked for me. It's a good job, otherwise I might not have been a monk. But the point was that I thought I was so sophisticated, but I got caught. Just like everybody does. Because those advertisements, they actually condition your will. The next time you go into a shop, shopping, ask yourself why you bought those things. Did you have any choice? Or have you been subconsciously controlled by the advertising? Actually, you have. You don't realize how easy you are to manipulate and control. How much your mind is totally conditioned by the environment around you. As a student, as a scientist, I was always interested in such things like hypnosis. and ghosts as well, and science, astronomy, that's all the interest in, like Buddhism, all these psychic phenomena. So I actually joined the Psychic Research Society in Cambridge, and it was a great club to join, and I still have made a lot of lifelong friends there. And one of the friends, I mentioned this to somebody, a guy called Tony Cornell, the last time I was in London, or in Cambridge, I had lunch with him. And even at that time, he would present his business card, which was a really cool business card. It had there Tony Cornell on the Ghost Hunting Council of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. He was one of the original Ghostbusters. And there's more ghosts in UK than there's probably any other country. And he spent his life, after a while he became the boss, the head ghost hunter in UK. And he's a personal friend. And every now and again, even in Australia, in the Sunday papers, if there's a famous haunting in that country, and somebody writes an article, it's him. If he doesn't actually write the article, he's a consultant. He is the expert, he was for many years, on ghosts in UK. So he's a great guy to talk with, a great guy to have a friend. Personal friend of the best Ghostbuster in the whole of the UK. But as well as hearing all these stories about ghosts, we'd also had all these other demonstrations, and every year we get a demonstration from a hypnotist, a professional hypnotist, who'd come into this big lecture theatre and give this, you know, really, really funny, entertaining, informative lecture to all these Cambridge students. It's one of the highlights of the year. I'd always say the hypnotist is coming today and you get all your friends to come along. Because it's really good fun. And part, it's entertaining but informative. And part of the lectures, every year, he would ask if anyone wants to be hypnotized. And of course, being students and willing to give a go to anything, there'd always be a couple of dozen students would get up on the stage to see if they could be hypnotized. Now, I got up on that stage too, but I'm not a hypnotic subject. It's very easy to find out who is, just how amenable you are to suggestions. Actually, all he did was actually to stand behind you and say, "You're falling, you're falling, you're falling, you're falling, you're falling backwards." And many people, you just stand behind it, you can't, it's amazing, you can't stop yourself. That suggestion, you just fall back. And the ones who actually fell back very quickly, they were the good hypnotic subjects. So he'd send the most of us away. And he'd always ask about three or four of them, then he'd choose the one who was the best. And he'd hypnotize this poor fellow. This fellow should have known that he's going to make an idiot of himself. And during hypnosis, they make them do all sorts of stupid things, which is always great fun. Students loved this. It was a hoot. But the most interesting thing was he would tell the student that when I touch my right earlobe, said the hypnotist, you will stand up, doesn't matter what's going on, you will stand up and sing the British National Anthem, God Save the Queen, in a loud voice. You tell him that. And of course, we'd see that, and we'd be, and then he'd sort of take him out of hypnosis, said, you won't remember anything I said during hypnosis, but when I touch my right earlobe, you'll stand up and sing the National Anthem. And then he'd come out of hypnosis, he would know anything what went on during that time. But we would, and we couldn't wait for this hypnotist to touch his earlobe to see what would happen. And he was a great entertainer, this hypnotist, because every now and again, he put his hand up but not quite go to his earlobe. So he kept us excited. But eventually he would do it, he'd touch his right earlobe. And this student, to the jeers and the laughter of the whole audience in the lecture theatre, would stand up and just start singing, God Save Us, in a really loud voice. And we would almost peeing ourselves with laughter. It was just so funny. And this wouldn't stop this guy. He would still continue until he finished singing the British National Anthem. That's what happens in hypnosis. But the interesting thing was, after we'd all stopped laughing, and this fellow sat down, he wasn't at all embarrassed. And the hypnotist asked him, why did you do that? But he would give an explanation that to him he'd freely chosen to sing that British National Anthem, and he'd give a rational reason for it. And it was fascinating to everyone listening that to him there was no difference than if he'd freely willed to do that himself. The scary thing was, you just do not know if you've been hypnotized or not. There is no difference. Which is why you can be hypnotized, brainwashed, conditioned to buying these things in the supermarket. You really think, for you, it feels as if you've freely chosen to buy that? You haven't. You've been hypnotized. You've been conditioned. You've been brainwashed. So where does your will come from? Your will, which you think is so free, which is at your command, is completely conditioned. Once you see this, it's a bit scary, because you really thought you were in control all this time. Many of you have had good meditations in this retreat, not because of you, but because of me. I have completely brainwashed and conditioned many of you, especially the suggestible ones, to meditating in this particular way. And you've done it, well done, because it works. But the difference between most hypnosis and my hypnosis, what I've hypnotized you to do, what I've conditioned you to do, what I've encouraged you to do, is nothing to let go. To stop the whole conditioning process. So you can actually see what's truly going on. Once you realize just how easy it is to condition others, you can actually be quite a powerful person in this world without other people knowing what you're up to. I'll tell you this, if you've got a husband who's very stubborn, or a wife who's very stubborn, it's so easy to change her if you know how. Most people do it wrong. Some years ago, I was second monk in my monastery. And the abbot at that time, some of you may know him, Ajahn Chakara, he was very, very stubborn. But I was smart. So I use this as an example to show how conditioning works and how you can use this conditioning. It's a bit sneaky, but if everyone knows, it actually can be very helpful for you. You're good people, so I don't mind telling you this. For example, because we were building our monastery, I said, why don't we build a hut over here? Now we're building 20 kutis in my monastery, 20 monks' huts. So I really thought it would be good to build a hut over here. But when you've got a stubborn person you're living with, if you just tell him, let's build a hut over here, he'd always say, no, 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 that's a bad idea, just out of principle. Because you know what husbands are like, they want to be in control. Or what wives are like sometimes, they want to, you know, be the ones who choose. So I would never do it that way. What I would do, we were walking along, when I thought he was really relaxed, I just mentioned casually, you know, I think that place over there on top of the hill would be a good place for a hut. And he would say, no, 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 that's a stupid place, don't be ridiculous. Now, most people's mistake will be to argue and to try and convince the other person through reason. That never works. If you try and argue, you lose. The thing to do is say, okay, fair enough, and drop it. The point is, the conditioning has already happened. Sometimes I need to say it twice. A couple of weeks later, when I thought he'd forgotten, I said to him, you know, I think we should build a hut over there on the hill. Okay, then that's a silly idea, don't be ridiculous. Okay, fair enough. At the very most, sometimes three times, when I thought he'd forgotten, I'd say again, I think we should build a hut over there. So that's a ridiculous idea. He wouldn't believe how well this worked. I just wait, 2 or 3 weeks later, I'd be walking with him, and he'd casually remark, you know, I think we should build a hut on the hill over there. And he'd think it was his idea. For him, he couldn't remember where the conditioning came from. I knew it's from me. In the same way, when you buy that dress, you don't know that you've been told to buy it through the advertisements. You think it's you. He thought it was him. So I'd always say, hey, that's a very brilliant idea of yours, Ajahn Chakara. Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Yeah, we should do that. How do you think of those great ideas? I don't know. You always flatter your superiors. It gets you lots of promotions. But the point was, I never needed to argue with him. All I needed to do was make those suggestions, maybe 2 or 3 times, to put them in his brain, in the mind, and if they were good suggestions, I knew they would be working through his mind, and he wouldn't realize where they came from. And yet, he would think it's a great idea, he would do it, and if it's someone's a boss, they always have to be in charge. So you let them be in charge, but you're the one who's working behind the scenes. Even with children as well, sometimes teenagers will never listen to their parents these days. Of course they used to when you were teenagers, maybe, sometimes, I don't know. But because teenagers are very rebellious, that's how you teach them and train them. You don't go arguing with them. All you need to do is just make those suggestions. You know, they think about it subconsciously. And if it really is a good suggestion, then they will recognize that. But the most important thing is they think it's their suggestion. And then they will follow it. So you can talk to teenagers, make the suggestions, be quiet. Make the suggestions, be quiet. So they don't know what's going on. And you'll find it works. That's how Judy got me to come here. She made it. It would be a good idea to go to IFA. That's a silly, I can't, I'm too busy. A couple of weeks later, it's a great, good idea, go to IPPO to teach a retreat. No, it's just too difficult, too busy. It worked, you tried it. Now look at me, I'm here, I got sucked into that. So, this is understanding the way will and choice works. You can understand how to work with it. So how does your will and choice work? Do you do stupid things sometimes? So what you do, and I've been telling this all during the retreat, program your will. Program your mindfulness. It's not that hard to do. If you want to sort of, say, get up earlier in the morning, all you need to do is just tell yourself, I will get up early in the morning. I will get up early in the morning. I will get up early in the morning. Program yourself. Keep on doing it. And you find you'll wake up in the morning and you'll choose to get up instead of sleeping in. You just change your will. If you're somebody who's always being negative and argumentative, you just tell yourself, I will not be so negative, I will not be so negative, I will not be so negative. You tell yourself that. I usually do it 3 times, because that's our tradition in Buddhism, do things 3 times. But if you keep reinforcing that, you find it happens. You do become less negative and more positive in life. Try that. If you get depressed, in the morning say, I will be happy, I will be happy, I will be happy. Say that, but don't push it too far. If you push it, you will rebel, you realize what's going on. But if you just give those suggestions, you find they work. There are people who give these talks in the top hotels of KL, Singapore, New York, LA, throughout the world. The only difference between what I'm saying and what they say is that they've got more hair and wear expensive suits. It's called motivational talks. And it's so easy to know how they work. Motivational talks is just conditioning your will. Making you believe in yourself. Making you think, I can do this. Encouraging you. Changing your will to be more positive, less negative. It's incredible just how well it works. Because it works well, those guys make thousands of dollars every talk. You're getting it for free here at IPA. But it's just as powerful. This is how you can change your whole life. Be more successful. Be more positive. Be more popular with the girls. More attractive to the boys. Whatever it is, just knowing what willpower is, you can condition it yourself. Knowing it's fully conditionable. There's no solid you self behind this calling the shots. But in particular, when you get into these jhanas, you know that you aren't the one who's in control of this life. That insight into an enormous part of non-self, to know the will is truly conditioned, explains a lot about your inability to always be happy, your inability to always be successful, your inability to do this, because you are not in charge. But it also means there's more encouragement to fully let go. If I'm not in charge anyway, why can't I just let go and relax? Whatever happens, it's not me, not mine, not itself. It's just Nama Rupa, just the five groups of existence, that's all. And this was the heart of the Buddha's famous second sermon. If any of you really want to see the most advanced, the most highest, the most profound Buddhist teaching, it was his second teaching, the one which made the first five enlightened monks. The first teaching just made them streamers, or made one of them streamers. The second thought made them all enlightened. The Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the teaching on non-self, where the Buddha said, if these five khandhas of the body, feelings, perception, mental formations, in other words, will and consciousness, if these were mine, we would be able to say, may they be like this, may they be like that. Because these are non-self, not me, not mine, not a self, we cannot order them at all. We cannot say, oh, may my body be like this, oh, may my feelings be like this, oh, may my perceptions be so, oh, may my will be so, oh, may my consciousness be so. They say this goes according to nature, not according to you. It belongs to nature, not to you. Because of that, all of this struggling will never bring you happiness. You should know that by now. How long have you been striving through life? How long have you been striving? Does that really get you anywhere? Except there's more headaches, more stress, more frustration. When you let go, you understand anatta, non-self. And you understand the way to end suffering through letting go, relinquishing, contentment, giving up. So it's important to understand this, to know there's nobody there. So sometimes people say, well, should I do anything? Should I really strive? Should I even sit for the sitting meditation? You have to, you've got no choice. Why should I keep the five precepts? It's already too conditioned already to stop. You have to, because you've got no choice. Remember, you can't choose not to. Do you understand what I'm saying? That is incredibly profound. It's also true. So that's half of emptiness, to see there's no one at the control panel of your life, completely conditioned. And you're very fortunate to have people like myself, to have CDs of Buddhism conditioning you. It's much better to have that conditioning you than the TV, or the internet, or pornography, or violent films. You are allowing yourself to be properly conditioned. That's why if you allow yourself to be conditioned this way for long enough, you're sure of becoming enlightened. That's why I said yesterday, I'll say it again tomorrow, one of the essential causes for enlightenment is the words of another. The words of another Arya, to condition you to see the Dhamma. You can't do it by yourself. And another interesting thing, just to throw an interesting point, you all know the story of the Buddha's enlightenment. After his enlightenment, he wouldn't teach. And it needed the god Brahma Sahampati to come down to the Buddha and request him to teach. Said, why was that? Why do you need... Surely the Buddha, having been enlightened, was compassionate. Surely he would do something like that. The point was that in his enlightenment, the result of that was his will was completely abolished. There's nothing to motivate him. So still, so peaceful, he can't even be moved to teach. He needed someone outside of himself to condition him to teach. If no one had asked him, he would have just been silent. If you understand the nature of the will, you understand why Brahma Sahampati was so necessary to take that enlightened being and make him into a teaching Buddha. He needed to be conditioned. Obviously an open slate didn't need much asking, just a suggestion was all it needed to start the Dhamma. Now, you may have some more insights into that story about Brahma Sahampati and how important it was. Without that, there'd be no Buddhism now. So one of my monks, with a cheeky monk, said, well, if God, Brahma Sahampati, was so responsible, we should all say thank God for Buddhism. We said, yeah, that's true, well done, you understood something. But that was not sort of a Christian God. Brahma Sahampati was actually a non-returner. He was an anagami under Kassapa the Buddha, the previous Buddha. So being an anagami, a monk who became a non-returner under Kassapa the Buddha, when he saw Gotama, sort of at that stage, he knew exactly what to do. So he had to go down and be the one who brings that little seed so he can start teaching. You do need that encouragement. In the same way, you need that encouragement and a suggestion from monk like myself to say let go, and you will, eventually. You need encouragement from monk like me to say let go and get into jhanas, and you do. Without encouragement, you will not be able to do it by yourself. So the second part of emptiness, which is very, you know, the doer is not a self. But the other half of the mind, the essential part of you where people think they live, is called the knower, that which knows. You may be able to sort of agree, but many of you will find it very difficult, unless you've gone into jhanas, that you are completely conditioned as far as your will, your doing, your choice is concerned. But when it comes to knowing, at least we think, well, we're the one who knows. People identify with being consciousness. They are that which knows. Isn't that the case? That's who you think you are? You know you're not your body, because your body gets old and sick, eventually you've seen it dying, you have to let your body go. But you even like your intelligence comes and goes. When you get Alzheimer's later on in your life, you lose your intelligence, your sharpness goes, your health goes. The strange thing about old people, I've seen it so many times, old people, they lose their hair, they lose their hearing, their eyes are no good, and their arms, their shape, their legs totter. Everything gets weaker and weaker except one thing for old people. The one thing which actually gets stronger as you get older is your mouth. Old people can really talk. Everything else wears out, but not their mouth. But you know you're not your body, and I've shown you, and eventually you'll find out you're not the chooser, you're not the will, it's a driverless bus. But the last refuge of who you think you are is that which knows. Now what happens in these jhanas is you start to see like the consciousness of mind very, very clearly. Before, you have all these different consciousnesses. Sight consciousness, hearing consciousness, smell consciousness, taste consciousness, and body consciousness, and mind consciousness. But a lot of the time, it feels the same when you see something. Isn't there something similar there to hearing? Isn't there something similar there to bodily touch? When you actually find out what the mind is, you can actually see what's going on, what the delusion is. Because this is what happens. When you say you see something, the mind immediately follows. What the eye sees, the mind then knows. What the ear hears, the mind knows what it heard. When the body feels a touch, the mind knows it felt that. And even when you have a mental impression, the mind knows that it knew. the mind always follows every sensory experience. Because of this, it's the following of the mind which gives every experience of the senses the same texture. That's what every sensory experience has in common, the mind following afterwards. That's why some years ago I gave a simile of the fruit salad. I gave a different type of fruit to every sense. Like the eye, I call like an apple. So an apple represents seeing something. An ear, I just said a cauliflower. It's apples of the eye, cauliflower ears. Nose, I call a banana. And for the mouth, I call a mango because they taste good. And for the body, I forget what it's called, a body. Say a rambutan, spiky. And the coconut was represented the mind sense, the sixth sense. So these six fruits or vegetables representing the six senses. The apple represents the eye, the cauliflower the ears, banana the nose, the mango the mouth, the rambutan the body, the coconut the mind. Now if you watch the different senses, what happens is it's like you have an apple followed by a coconut, another apple, another coconut, maybe then a banana and a coconut, maybe a mango and a coconut, maybe a cauliflower and a coconut, maybe a rambutan and a coconut. There's always a coconut in the middle. This is actually what happens. It's like, first of all, there's an apple. The apple disappears and there's a coconut comes immediately afterwards. Coconut disappears and there's immediately a banana. Banana disappears and there's immediately a coconut afterwards. Because they flow so quickly, it's the presence of the coconut gives it the sameness. But really, every moment of sensory experience is completely discrete, lives by itself. And there's no connection between one and the other. Once you can recognize that, you recognize that the illusion of the continuity of consciousness, it just happens because you don't recognize what the mind is and how the mind always pops up to give everything the same type of taste. Once you see that, you see that it's not true. There's no continuity there at all. The flow of consciousness is like a beach. On the beach, if you don't look carefully, you think it's a continuous stretch of sand, unbroken, just sand. But if you look more closely, you find that beach is made up of individual grains of sand. There's no continuous sandiness there. It's just one grain next to another grain next to another grain. Consciousness is made up of individual events. Now a coconut, now a banana. When you look very carefully, even those grains of sand aren't actually touching. There's gaps between them. When you see the fragmentary nature of consciousness, you see that consciousness is just a moment long and another consciousness arises afterwards, then you understand there can't be any being always here which knows. Every moment of knowing is different. What this does, it completely demolishes the idea of a continuous self behind the eyes, behind the ears, just listening to everything. That is a delusion. The knower completely comes and goes. It changes so fast. Every moment of consciousness is a different moment. There's no being there, always knowing. You have to see the mind so clearly to understand that. To understand that knowing is fragmentary. There are gaps between it. In the same way when I was teaching you how to be silent, if you look carefully you can see the spaces between the thoughts. If you're perceptive, you'll be able to infer the spaces between conscious moments. When there's nothing there. When there's just emptiness. If you don't believe me, then you can go deeper in your meditation. One of the great things about jhanas, when you enter the jhana, the body has disappeared and also the will has disappeared. As you go through the jhanas, second, third, fourth, and especially into the immaterial jhana states, you realize that what's happening there is actually consciousness is disappearing stage by stage. The mind is unraveling and disappearing. For example, in the third immaterial state, it's called the state of nothingness. There is truly nothing there, but you're perceiving that nothing. That's the difference between having nothing at all. What you're perceiving is nothing, but the perceiver is there. When you let go of that perceiving, there's no even perceiver there, but you're perceiving there's no perceiver. That's why it's called neither perception nor non-perception. So the last subtle stage before the mind completely turns off. When the mind turns off completely, when knowing stops, that's called the most refined stage of meditation, the state of cessation. That state of cessation the Buddha called Nibbana here and now. It's a taste of Nibbana. Going back to that thousand petal lotus, you want to find the jewel in the heart of the lotus. The meaning of the great Tibetan mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. I worship the jewel in the heart of the lotus. So you're opening up that lotus. In these jhanas you're going closer and closer to what's in the middle. The last layer of petals is the state called neither perception or non-perception. So subtle, so profound, there's hardly anything there. But when that opens up, you see what is in the very center of the lotus called you. In the center of your body is the mind. In the center of the mind, this is what you find. The last petal opens up, and there you see the famed jewel in the heart of the lotus. And what's that? Nothing. Emptiness. Completely void. That is the jewel. Emptiness. Nothing there. That's not what you expect for a jewel. But once you understand that's the only thing it could have been, and the most wonderful thing, the most precious of all jewels, emptiness. Only when there's emptiness can there be total freedom. And I'll finish off with one of my own personal stories. This personal story was from my life with the great master Ajahn Chah. Again, finishing off with emptiness. When Ajahn Chah, before he had his sickness, before he went into a coma, he was getting sick. He was complaining about dizziness, not feeling all that well. So being Western monks, not only were we very concerned about our teacher, we were also concerned that he'd sent us to a monastery about 6 kilometers from his monastery, where we were learning how to run our own monasteries. Ajahn Chah was incredibly wise. He didn't just teach us to be monks, he taught us to be teachers. That's why we've got so many monasteries, you know, which are from his tradition. So once the monks had trained with him, he sent them to their own monastery. Okay, you learn how it is, what it is to run a monastery. When things went wrong, he'd come and fix it up. But at least you were there learning. So this monastery, where I spent many years, is called Wat Nanachat. Some of you have been there. It's only 6 kilometers, a walking distance, to Ajahn Chah's monastery, Wat Nong Bapong. Because he was at Wat Bapong too much, because we wanted to see him, somebody suggested to build him a sauna. Now actually saunas are allowable for monks. In the original monasteries, in the time of the Buddha, they had saunas. So saunas were not invented in Sweden. They are Buddhists, they came from India 2,500 years ago. So, we decided to build him a sauna. And it was the first time they had a sauna in the northeast. We built one. Very simple one, but very effective. Because Ajahn Chah would come every week to take his sauna. And that was great. Number one, we were serving our teacher. But also, because he came to the monastery, he'd always give us a Dharma talk before he went to his sauna. When he was in the sauna, if he had any questions about meditation, he could ask them. It was a great deal we did. And we'll give you a sauna, you give us some teachings. Basically, that was all what it was. So he'd come every week. And because you were his disciple, you'd actually help him in the sauna. You know, you sort of get his bathing cloth for him, maybe massage his back, sort of, when he came out, get some water, you know, rinse out his bathing robe, get the towel for him. Because, you know, this is actually what we were trained to do, and it's wonderful being able to do those services for your teacher. After a while, you got into it, and you were sort of fighting to be the one who did it. It's a strange thing, like, for Westerner, you're not supposed to do that, you're supposed to be so independent. I remember the time, just going off on a tangent, that when I first went to these monasteries, because when you went on alms round, you walked in the dirt with no shoes on, that when you came back to the monastery, the first thing you did was to wash your feet. But when Ajahn Chah came in, he never washed his feet. They had all these monks would jump up from the seat and wash his feet for him. And I thought that was completely ridiculous. Number one, I always thought that Ajahn Chah was now old enough to wash his own feet. And number two, there's about 20 monks that are trying to wash his feet. They could hardly get a toe each. And I thought that the rational thing to do is have a roster. So you have a roster, you can organize it. You wash his feet on Monday, you on Tuesday, you on Wednesday. That's how Westerners think. You know, you'd be reasonable. But they wouldn't have that. It was just a free for all. Whoever got there first, you know, wash the foot. So again, because I was scientifically trained, now I was always wanting to find out what was going on. So I decided one day that today I'm going to wash Ajahn Chah's foot just to see what all these guys are into. So you know, why are they doing this? And so I was poised. I made sure I got back early from the alms round and I was poised like a cat. You know, ready, because when Ajahn Chah came around the corner, I was going to jump up. You had to be fast. I was waiting and waiting. I saw Ajahn Chah and I jumped up and I was racing all these other monks. And I got a toe all to myself. And I was so happy. I got a toe of my teacher. And I was washing it and caressing it. It was only a little toe. But it made me so happy and I realized why you do service for others. It's irrational. I mean, you can wash a toe. It must be just so awful having this horde of people trying to wash your feet. But it was, we needed to do that. You needed to serve your teacher. And I was so happy afterwards. I realized what service is all about. It's not that you need it done. Other people need to do it. So when it came to in the sauna, we were always rushing to be the one who would sort of who washes bathing cloth or whatever. We never thought it like it's merit to do this. It was just fun to do it. You got a lot of happiness and joy out of serving somebody. But this one day, he'd been coming for weeks and months, and he really liked his saunas, we loved his talks. This one occasion, he gave this amazing talk. It was in Thai, but I could understand Thai by then. He gave this amazing talk. You know what it's like after you heard a good talk? You just so inspired. And his other monks said, for once I said, okay, other monks, you can help Ajahn Chah. I went to the back of the hall and sat down and meditated because I was so inspired. And as I meditated, I just got to a really, really peaceful state. You know, like many of you have, just so still. Oh, you love it. You don't know how long you sit meditation for. When I opened my eyes, I realized it wasn't that long, maybe an hour and a half. And I thought, maybe Ajahn Chah is still in the sauna. Maybe I can go and help him. So I walked towards the sauna. But I was actually too late. Ajahn Chah had already finished because he was walking in the opposite direction, accompanied by two Thai men. So we were crossing paths. Now, if you have a great teacher like Ajahn Chah, he knows when you've had a deep meditation. He looks at you. He looks right through you. He noticed, he was reading my mind. He read the fact I'd just come out of a very deep samadhi. So, he decided to enlighten me there and then. I already mentioned, if you have the jhanas, a deep meditation, and you have the words of an enlightened being, you have all it takes to get enlightened. So he tried there and then to give me full arahat, full enlightenment. He looked at me and he said, "Rama Wamsa, why?" He asked me the question, why. That was a very subtle moment. It could have gone either way. Either stay in samsara and be an ordinary person or become enlightened. And I fell, keeping samsara, being an ordinary person. I said, "I don't know." That's what I said, I'm stupid. "I don't know," the question why. And his face eased and he just laughed at his stupid Western disciple. Well, then he looked at me again. He said, "Listen, Brahma Wamsa, I will tell you the answer. If anyone asks you that question again, why, this is the answer. The answer is, there is nothing." He looked at me and said, "Do you understand?" I said, "Yes." He said, "No, you don't." And then he laughed and walked away. Now that was one of those amazing experiences with a very unique master. Why? The answer is, there's nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. And that ends the talk. So, any questions? Yes, go question in the back. He asked me, why? Why? That's the question. Why? The answer is, there's nothing. Do you understand? Emptiness, there's no one there. There's nothing. Wow, what an amazing answer. So the only way to understand those answers is actually get out of the lake. Don't be a tadpole anymore. Be a frog. So, that's what emptiness means. That's what doing means. That's what consciousness means. That's what will is. You find the person who asked that question. Who asked that question? Nobody did. There's no one there. It's really funny looking at the looks on your faces. You've all heard before emptiness, non-self. You've all heard it so many times. But now you know how to understand it, how to see it for yourself. When you start, first of all, you can't understand that. It's a stupid teaching. How can there be emptiness? I'm here. I feel me. I ask a question. I hear the answer. I'm here. That's what it seems like. If you go deeper into it and you have the power of the extra data given by jhanas, you'll be so surprised. Not only is the driverless bus, but the person sitting in the seat is just a phantom as well. There's nobody there. Just cause and effect. As I mentioned yesterday, from the Visuddhimagga, the great treatise of meditation, the path to Nibbana is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but no one enters it. you disappear. You see the illusion of the self, and then nirvana happens. If you don't, as long as you think you're there, you'll have to keep being reborn again and again and again, living the same delusion, always being worried about why life is sometimes happy, why life is sometimes painful, wondering why you can't control it, until you realize the reason why you can't control it, because you're not there. Completely cause and effect. That's all there is. The web of delusion. Are you scared? You should be. Because I'm challenging the deepest of your attachments. That's why the Buddha even said in the suttas that when he teaches talks like this on non-self, some people get terrified. Their idea of themselves is being completely threatened. The deepest attachment is being pulled apart. You are just a child of nature. Cause and effect, just like the clouds, which come together and then part. Standing down here, they look so solid, as if you could sit upon them. When you rise in the aircraft, you pass right through them. It is vapor, that's all. Nothing solid at all. In science, I learned that this earth, which seems so solid, is just full of holes. The atoms which make up the marble on which you're sitting, they're so small and so far apart. It's 99.9999999999999999% emptiness. And even those atoms, if you look at them, just the electrons and the nuclei, the whole atom itself is 99.9999999999 and a lot of other nines, complete emptiness. If you look at that nucleus, the proton, you see it's just a few quarks. It's 99.9999999% emptiness. Ask any scientist and they'll say there's nothing there. It's just a play of forces giving the illusion of solidity, giving the illusion of energy. Just a play of forces, that's all. But nothing really solid. Ask any scientist, they'll confirm what I've said. All that's solid and hard, it's just a play of forces. It's not real. But we think it is. That is our illusion. Scared yet? Yes, in the back. I work in advertising. I advertise the Dhamma. I advertise my Dhamma talks, advertise my book, advertise my retreat center. I'd be conditioning you all week to buy my book and have me sign it. And it's worth, lots of you have bought my book. You know what you're doing. It doesn't mean you stop doing these things, but you know exactly how it all works. And you make sure it's wholesome, it's good, for the benefit of all beings. So it means that in your life as a layperson, you choose correct livelihood. Livelihood which doesn't sort of harm or oppress other beings, but which is of service to society. In other words, you know, you're a doctor, you're a builder, you're a business person selling products like microphones so monks like me can give talks or whatever. So you contribute to society. At the same time, you know what's going on. So you work hard. When it's time to rest, you rest hard. In other words, you really let go. When it's time to do your spiritual practice, you give yourself to your spiritual path. So you are an average, all-round person, well-balanced. It's a wonderful thing you can do. But you have your duties to your family. You have your duties to your country. You have your duties to your religion. Keep doing them. It's not that hard to live in the world once you have wisdom. In fact, it makes it much easier. Once you know the rules of the game, once you know what's going on, then you don't get so confused anymore. When, say, a tsunami happens, or someone close to you dies suddenly, you are not taken aback anymore. When somebody calls me and say a close disciple has suddenly died, I always say, I expected that. What? They're only 30. They just died of a heart attack. Did you know they had heart disease? What do you mean you expected that? I said, listen, if they're born, they can die at any time. I expect any of my disciples to die at any moment. I expect that. I understand the laws of nature. Sometimes people criticize me and call me a stupid monk. Do I get upset? No, I expect that. No matter what you do, there will always be somebody who complains. No matter what you do, there always somebody thinks you're the best monk on earth. Both of them are wrong. Look, even the Buddha said that no one in this world lives just with praise or just with blame. We always get some of each. Even the Buddhas got blamed. Even though there's nothing wrong, they did nothing wrong, still people blame them. So when people blame me and call me stupid or call me an idiot or call that the most stupid talk, you're really wrong, Ajahn Brahm, you should become a Christian. I don't care. I expect that. That's why I never get upset. Now you understand the laws of nature. Once you understand the laws of nature and you accept those, then you stop screaming at the bus driver. It should be this way. How many people complain? This happens to me because they come up to me as a monk. The ladies complain about their husbands. The husbands complain about their wives. Those who are single want to get married. Those who are married want to be single again. They complain about their kids. They complain about their mothers-in-law. My goodness. This is just life. Stop complaining. It's incredible when you actually recount, you start to listen to people. They're all the same complaints. First time I became a monk and I started becoming a counsellor, and people would come to me and they'd say something. That's really interesting. The second person who came, I've heard that before. The third person who came, here we go again. Basically the same problems, just with different characters, that's all. So once you understand the laws of life, you can expect it. When you meditate on a retreat, you can expect to be tired. There's nothing wrong with that. There are days when you get just so bored. There's nothing wrong with that. That's part of nature. It's not your fault. There's no one in there. There's sometimes when you get so high, you get this incredible nimittas and jhanas. Don't feel proud of yourself. At last I've made it. It's not your fault you get jhanas. There's no one in there. And it's great being like a monk, because I sit up here in a place where you can very easily grow a lot of ego. The only reason why I get so much praise is because to the extent of how much I'm disappeared. The more a monk is disappeared, everything is let go of, the more praise they get. If you really want to be famous, disappear. When your ego completely goes, that's when you get the most famous. Understand? Yeah, in the back.
Yes? You, yeah. Okay, well, okay, you go first. Whoever gets up first, ask a question first. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that sometimes it's a bit of a joke. Because I remember this one story. Real Zen Buddhism is the same as all other Buddhism. It's hard work, you get into deep meditation, a lot of sitting, a lot of keeping your precepts. The quick way is usually, if you try and find shortcuts, you usually get lost. Because there's this one monk watching this story, one of my very funny story. He was walking from place to place, and he hadn't had good luck with getting alms food. But somebody said, look, there's a Buddhist who owns this restaurant over there. She'll probably give you some food. So he went into this restaurant, and it was a really good restaurant. And the owner, this lady, was a devout Buddhist. So he went up to her and said, look, I'm a monk. I'm on alms round. If you're a Buddhist, here's my bowl. And the lady said, look, I want to find out what type of Buddhist you are, first of all. He said, I'm a practicing Buddhist, I'm well versed in the suttas. And the woman said, okay, look, if you give me a teaching which makes sense, I will feed you. So the monk said, aha, this is my chance. He quoted the Heart Sutra. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. He never needs to go any further. The lady put her hands up and said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Sit over there at the table, monk. I'll bring you your lunch. And the monk was so happy. He'd inspired this lady that he was going to get a good meal for the first time in days. Not just an ordinary meal. This was a really good restaurant. So this poor monk was salivating. As the restaurant owner, the woman herself, came with this huge tray. Like this morning's meal, like covered over to keep the flies out. And she put the tray in front of the monk. And she opened it. There was nothing there. And the lady said, if form is emptiness, and emptiness is form, monk, eat emptiness. That's one of those stories. One of my other stories that shouldn't be too cheeky, but they said monks would be cheeky back to me on Theravada, but one of the favourite stories which I have in Zen and Theravada, the difference between Zen and Theravada. There's two monks, and they saw this flag. And one of the monks said, you see that flag sort of moving in the wind? And the second monk said, the flag's not moving, the wind is moving. No, no, the flag's moving. No, the wind is moving. No, the flag is moving. So they decided to go to the master to find out who was right. I went to the master and said, this monk says the flag moved. I say the wind moved. Which of us is right? And the Zen monk said, you're both wrong. The mind is moving. And then they weren't so satisfied with that. So the three of them went to the Thai forest monk. And they said, he says that the flag is moving. I say the wind is moving. My master says the mind is moving. Which one of you is right? And the forest monk said, you're all wrong. Your mouths have been moving. That's an interesting. Your mouth moves. That's a trouble. So any other question anyone has? What emptiness or anything else? Yes, go on, yeah. Correct, yeah. You had to ask this question. See? Is it a life already? Yeah, I had no choice. It's like, if any of you have done any science, any physics, it's like chaos theory. Chaos theory is a beautiful theory of science. It says that everything is cause and effect, but it can't be predicted. In a sense, it is destined, but unpredictable. In other words, everyone knows the laws of science. They know exactly what should happen. You toss a coin up. When you toss the coin up, because it's all according to the laws of science, you find its momentum, the speed of this, the speed of that, the viscosity of the air, you find out how high it goes, the hardness of the place where it hits, the way it will roll. In theory, it's all predictable. But the point of much of life, that life is on a knife edge. A slight variation of where you actually flip it up, and it can be heads or tails. So even though it's determined, it's not predictable. It's halfway in between. It's neither determined nor undetermined. It's a beautiful middle way again of the Buddha. Sometimes we think it's all destined, or sometimes it's all free will. There's a third option. Cause and effect. But so complex, it's impossible to predict. If you understand that, you know why fortune tellers can never be accurate. No way can they tell the fortunes. That's why I say, and I know that Chinese people just love fortune tellers. Never trust a poor fortune teller. For obvious reasons. If they're any good, they'd be rich by now. Never trust a poor fortune teller. If they can't tell their own fortunes, how can they tell yours? Okay, any other questions before we finish up today? Because we have to go. One last question, then we turn the hall over to emptiness. Yes. Is virtue also conditioned by the mind? Yeah, it's conditioned in a sense that it's obvious it's in one's best interest to be virtuous. The essence of virtue was taught by the Buddha to his son Rahula, and this is for everybody who finds it difficult to keep the Buddhist five precepts. Anyone who finds it hard to keep the five precepts every day, keep the two precepts. And the two precepts are, don't do anything by body, speech or mind which harms or hurts another. Precept number two, don't do anything by body, speech or mind which harms or hurts yourself. The two precepts. Now when you put it that way, it becomes quite obvious why you have virtue. And the virtue literally becomes conditioned by the wise understanding of happiness. Do you want to have a good time? Then be good. It's obvious. Good people have good times. Happy times. If you break your virtue, you just cause pain and suffering to yourself and other people. That's all. So all virtue is actually creating happiness for yourself and others. Once you see it with wisdom, it's such an obvious thing to do. That's why it's actually unvirtuous to smoke cigarettes. It's not breaking precepts, but breaking those two precepts. It's harming or hurting yourself. What do you want to do it for? What do you want to harm and hurt yourself for? And harm and hurt other people when they see you die young. It makes no sense. Even like scolding somebody, getting angry at them. That just hurts yourself. You feel terrible after you scolded somebody. And it hurts them. It's a stupid thing to do. So, be virtuous. Keep the two precepts. And if you keep the two precepts, then you understand why wisdom conditions virtue. For a lot of people, fear conditions their virtue. They keep the precepts because they're afraid of what other people might say. Or they're afraid of, they go to hell afterwards. Or they're afraid their pastor will tell them, you're going to go to hell with all your family. A lot of times people keep virtue through fear. Just like I learned to keep the school rules. Actually, I didn't learn to keep the school rules through fear of the cane. I just got very wise never to get caught again. All I learned through fear is not to get caught. I never really learned why those rules were there in the first place. It was only later on. So this is why the best way to have virtue is learn the reason for that. That it's so it doesn't harm yourself, doesn't harm others. Ah, yeah, that makes sense. Therefore virtue becomes just a consequence, it's conditioned through wisdom. So wise people are always virtuous. Wise people are always compassionate. Does that answer the question, sort of? Okay, so that's enough for tonight. Coming next is the big one. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about enlightenment itself. If you want to know what enlightenment is, if you've heard it many times, but you don't know what it truly is and how it happens, tomorrow night might be your night. So, tomorrow night is enlightenment night. And maybe I have now done the advert and you will have no choice but to come tomorrow. So see you tomorrow. Let's share the merits, transfer the merits with all the two speakers.
Idam me nyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinang hotu sukhita Om Tu Yatayo Sadhu Sadhu Sadhu.
You see, I've conditioned you to do the same now. Goodbye, everybody.